Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in to episode 38 of the Southeast Asia Travel Show. Today, we're joined by Stuart McDonald, Bali-based publisher and co-founder of Travelfish. Welcome back, Stuart.
Thanks for having me, Hannah.
Yeah, well, it's been 6 months since we last spoke. So what have you been up to during that time?
Oh, I've been spending all of my time in Bali because I can't really go anywhere else.
No big travel plans.
I don't think I'm unique in that situation. We've just been in Bali. The kids are doing distance ed now, so I've been doing the schooling for them. And I've just spent the last week or so down on a beach in southern Bali because it's school holidays.
Lovely.
And to prove that Stuart is actually in Bali, you can probably hear the surf in the background. Where actually are you, Stuart?
I'm at Bingen. Down in the
are you doing some surfing?
I did quite a bit yesterday and the day before, and I can almost walk again now. So
and what's it like there at the moment, where you are at the moment? Pretty quiet?
It's very midweek, it's very, very quiet. On the weekend there was a few people here. I mean not anything like what it would normally be this time of year. I mean, looking out the break now, there's maybe a dozen people out there. I mean, other days there's only been two or three surfers out there. It's great. I mean, from a visitor's point of view, it's obviously not so great for the businesses.
The last time we spoke, Stuart, was the beginning of April, which is 6 months ago, which is it just seems like a lifetime ago. I mean, This is a big, big question to ask, but how has Bali changed and not changed during that period? I mean, you've gone through sort of peaks and troughs.
Well, day-by-day life hasn't changed very much overall. I mean, we had the domestic reopening to tourism and more businesses have reopened. The beaches were reopened and then been an explosion in cases. I mean, particularly once domestic tourism was reopened and particularly the airport was reopened. So the two biggest centers of flights into Bali were Surabaya and Jakarta, which are home to the two highest number of COVID cases in the country. So not surprisingly, Bali's numbers increased. Then the hospitals filled up and then the death rate increased. It sort of dropped back a little bit. I mean, if you look at it pre-reopening to domestic travel, Bali's case numbers were, the 7 day average was around about 50 a day. And then within a month of reopening to domestic travel, it went up to 160 a day. And since then it dropped and then it picked back up again. And at the moment we're floating at around 100, 110, 120 a day. There's been some suggestions that the reason there was the big dip was because the hospitals were running out of the reagent required for the swab testing. But, I mean, that's something that's on Facebook, so, I mean, who knows if it's actually true or not. So, at the moment, they're very, very determined on making people wear masks. And generally, that's pretty well adhered to. I mean, in a couple of tourism quarters like Canggu and Ubud, particularly, there's always a bit of social media outrage about so-and-so foreigner who's not wearing a mask. But when I'm on the bike riding around, I would say most people are wearing masks now, and certainly in cafes and restaurants and business places, there's masks everywhere. If the cops catch you without it, I think it's either a small fine or some push-ups on the spot.
I mean, it's like you said, you've been going out and around the island. What are your impressions about, you know, what's the overall impact of COVID-19 on Bali, or any specific examples you could give us about how it's affected the island's tourism?
Well, I mean, it's been devastating to tourism. Vast numbers of hotels and cafes, restaurants remain closed. If you go down through the traditionally mass market destinations like Legian and Kuta, it's like a ghost town, you know. I mean, it's picked up a little bit with the pickup in domestic tourism, but it's still a fraction of what it used to be like. And so there's still plenty of hotels that are closed. I read a stat, I think it was last month, where the occupancy rate in the hotels was something like 3%. but I'm not clear if that is 3% of the hotels that are still open or whether it includes properties that have closed. I'm not sure about that. So, yeah, it's pretty grim. Interestingly, when I was coming down to the beach the other day, I got a Gojek from my house to down to the beach area. And I was talking to the driver because it's about a 45-minute ride. And he was from Banyuwangi in East Java. And so he had gone back to Java in, I think it was April, he said, because there was just no business. It was a much stricter lockdown at that stage. He had then come back in late August, but he said that he was having, it was still a fraction of the business that he got back in the day. And he wants more foreigners to come because he reckons we tip a lot more than the Javanese. I mean, it's pretty grim times.
If we go back a little bit, Stuart, if we go back to sort of mid-June when the Bali governor announced this sort of three-phase plan for reopening, first opening up the tourism businesses and a lot of other businesses across Bali, then having the domestic reopening, and then at the plan at the time was to reopen in September. I mean, what was the feeling like? Was there anticipation? Was there a sense of hope which has been dashed now? What was it like back at that point?
It's a difficult one to answer, really. Depended very much on who you spoke to, because a lot of people felt that the 9/11 date was ambitious and very unlikely to happen. But others were like banking on it. Like a couple of the cookie cutter, like the mini hotel style places near my place, they started advertising for staff again. And now they're closed still. The 9/11 date was also always a tentative date from the Bali government's point of view. But the thing is that they were doing the whole thing backwards. You know, you can't sort of say, okay, we're open for business without having agreements in place with other countries that are going to let their people come here.
Sure.
So, I mean, that, like Australia's obviously the classic example in that case. I mean, I certainly wasn't very surprised to see the 9/11 date push back.
Then as things started to open up, Stuart, you mentioned that, you know, tourists are coming back from the two big cities, Surabaya, the two big source markets, Surabaya and Jakarta. But you mentioned that Kuta is a bit of a ghost town. So where are they actually traveling to?
Well, they are still going to Kuta Legian, also down into Nusa Dua. But it's just a fraction of the numbers. I mean, Indonesian domestic tourism into Bali has always been the number one inbound. It's always been far larger than the international market. But it's still what it, the volume of people who are coming in now are still a fraction of what used to come in back in the day.
And is that because of fear factor, or is that because there's not enough flights, or is it a combination of all those things?
It's hard to say. I mean, there's quite a few flights where I'm staying at the moment. I can see the approach, and the flights have been trundling in pretty regularly. I think there's a fair bit of fear. The airlines are not supposed to be filling to capacity, but there's been multiple reports of them just jamming the passengers in. You often only need a rapid test, which is a fairly dubious accuracy. So I think there's those kind of considerations. I mean, when you look at the charts of Bali's infection rates, there looks to be a very clear relationship between reopening to tourism and the numbers going through the roof. But people are only coming here for like weekends and that kind of thing from Surabaya and Jakarta. So are they coming here, are they catching it here and going back and taking it home, or are they bringing it with them? I mean, nobody knows. There was a story this morning about two Jakartans who had gone from Jakarta to Bali to Komodo or to Labuan Bajo, and there they've just tested positive for COVID. So they've been traveling, they've flown, that's two flights, and traveling around in Bali. The story wasn't specific where they went, and now they're in Komodo. So how many people have been exposed in that situation?
I mean, this is the problem that we're starting to see everywhere, isn't it? It's the circular impact. So it occurs with returnees going back to countries, people going on holiday, then coming back. You know, it's not just a case about opening up the destination that you go to. It's about what happens when you re-import or bring the virus back with you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Stuart and I saw that the authorities in Bali are still not kind of officially linking the rising cases to tourism, are they? I saw maybe last week they said it was like locals, it's all locally transmitted, therefore it's kind of nothing to do with tourists.
Yeah, there was a story yesterday where they were suggesting that perhaps there is a relationship between the two, but there was no clear evidence. I think the other thing with the numbers is it's very difficult to take them all that credibly. A friend of my, or somebody who my wife knows, a foreigner who died a few weeks ago of COVID, he wasn't reported in the numbers because just before he died, he tested negative. So they don't count him, even though in previous tests, like he had COVID, but they cured it just before he died. So that means he doesn't go into the numbers. So it's that kind of thing doesn't really breed a lot of comfort, I guess, through the numbers, because people are thinking, well, yeah, these are pretty shoddy.
Yeah, definitely.
Stuart, I follow you on Twitter, and you've been quite a strong advocate, particularly over the last couple of weeks, about actually closing the airport. I mean, what are your current thoughts on that?
Absolutely. Shut it down yesterday. Like, I don't even have to think twice about that. Bali is an island, so there's a certain degree of natural protection. And if they shut the airport down, if they mandate swab testing at the east and west ferry ports, then that will limit how many more potential cases are coming in here. And then you use that window to try and get on top of what's happening here. And particularly given the level of cases in Java, and that the two main ports coming into here are the two highest numbers of cases, it just seems insane to be encouraging domestic tourism. I mean, every time I read a story that's saying, oh, we need to support domestic tourism, we need to keep the industry going, I think the journalists really need to be asking politicians, how many collateral deaths do you think are a reasonable amount in order to keep the tourism business in business, you know?
Yeah.
Indonesia, I mean, now they're looking at, God, I don't know how many cases there are now, about, what, 300,000 or something? I mean, they missed their moment very early on, when they should have been concentrating tenfold times on contact tracing, because they've never had the infrastructure to do vast numbers of swab testing. They should have been doubling down on contact tracing and quarantining people. They have months to do that. Once you've got 250,000 cases in the country, contact tracing is like, God, where do you start? I think they're in a very, very difficult position now. And they squandered a period where they probably could have made some different decisions that may have ended up with the country not being quite in the situation that it is.
Yeah. One of the questions I've been asked a few times in interviews recently is the difference between Asia and Europe in terms of opening up. Europe had the summer, Asia mostly has stayed closed down. But one of the case points I always point out is Bali, because, you know, Bali did open up, albeit only for domestic tourists, and it's having pretty much the similar impact to some of the European destinations when they reopened over the summer. And now everybody's retrenching again, everybody's going back into lockdown. I mean, do you see that's what possibly could happen in Bali?
Well, yeah, there's been rumours that they're going to close the beaches again on October 5. But the thing is, they don't need to close the beaches. What they need to close is the beach clubs. You going surfing or sunbaking on the beach or something like that is, in the scheme of things, a fairly low-risk activity. But going to a packed club where nobody is wearing a mask, everyone is getting hammered, it's like higher risk. So it's like, leave the beaches open, but close the beach clubs. They need to be more selective and saying, okay, what is really a high-risk activity here? And so these businesses, we're going to close. And let's see how that goes for trying to have a managed kind of lockdown. I mean, we've just been through a very important ceremony period here. So there's been a whole bunch of religious ceremonies, which can often have a ton of people. And so now people are waiting to see if we're going to see another surge 2 weeks from then, of positive cases that sort of flow on from these religious activities.
So 6 months ago, you were saying you thought it might take 2 years before international travel could recover. Have you changed your mind about that? Do you think it's going to be longer now? Shorter? It's not going to be shorter, is it?
I don't think it's going to be shorter. I think it's a difficult one to answer because everywhere is a different case. So there's, like, if you look at, say, Thailand and Singapore, for example, So there's a story this morning about Singapore that they're going to reopen to it's Australia, except for Victoria and Vietnam, from memory. But in at least in Australia's case, they can't get out of Australia unless the government says so. And then when you arrive in Singapore, you've got to pay $300 for a swab test. And then when you go back to Australia, you've still got to shell out, what is it, $3,000 for a two-week quarantine. How many people are actually up for doing that when normally you go to Singapore for like 3 days or 4 days? It's a similar situation in Thailand. This special tourist visa thing, that it's like a one-stop shop where it's a 22-step process to get the visa. Like, I get the government's desire to restart tourism in some way, but all this does is breed uncertainty and confusion. And, you know, can I go to Thailand or can't I go to Thailand? Will I have to stay? Like, there's a story saying that on Samui, there's going to be 1,000 CCTV cameras across the island to make sure the foreigners don't sneak out of the resorts when they're supposed to be quarantining. I mean, it sounds like something out of a TV show, like Escape from COVID Island or something. I mean, it's ludicrous. I think for a lot of people, it's just going to be like, screw it, travel domestically. Yeah. Because there's just too many moving parts. And governments are often just coming up with these unilateral ideas. I mean, did Singapore talk to Australia before saying, yeah, Australians can come here? Because there's not much point saying Australians can come here if Australia isn't going to let Australians out.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think there's a lot of political games going on to try and push opening so that, you know, as you said there, these moves tend to be a bit unilateral, but that's basically just trying to jolt the system to get other people to think the same way. But it doesn't really seem to be proving to be the case. I liked your point there, Stuart, about moving parts and, you know, how it's very difficult to talk of a global or even a regional recovery at the moment, because every part, and in even in ASEAN here, we have like multi-speeds in terms of the way the virus is being managed, the leakage in terms of cases across borders, things like that. A few weeks ago, you proposed an alternative idea for Thailand's reopening strategy, which is quite interesting. You focused mostly independent travelers. But what was your thinking at that time, and have you changed your mind since?
Not really. I think I still maintain that if a destination is going to require a two-week quarantine on arrival, then they need to be targeting people who traditionally spent a long time in the country. There's no point targeting a market that normally comes to Thailand for 4 days and saying you've got to do 2 weeks in quarantine before you can have your 4 days. You need to go and target a nationality that traditionally would spend 21 or 28 days in country. Then the 2 weeks is a possibility. And so what I was suggesting was the budget travelers who tend to travel for a longer period in Thailand, even though they may spend less money, are a possible market. That's assuming people still have the money to actually take a long holiday. But all the focus from the Thai administration has been on high-end properties. I mean, some of the alternative quarantine hotel rates were insanely expensive. So what I was suggesting was that you could feeding something else into a more community-focused, more affordable option. And it was also working with existing properties in the country to sort of say, well, look, we want you to pick your best 20 guests over the last couple of years and say, why don't you come back?
Yeah, I mean, I really loved that idea. I think especially the getting the community involved, because I think we've seen, you know, a lot of governments just making unilateral decisions as well, aren't they? They're not really involving the citizens in the decision whether to invite back tourists or how tourism should look like.
Right. Sorry to interrupt, but I mean, there was a story yesterday where the Thai Ministry of Foreign Affairs has just launched this new website called Thailand In Now or Thailand Now or something or other. It's just government propaganda. It doesn't really, it's like a positive spin on all the news coming out of Thailand, but it doesn't really serve any purpose. And I doubt that they would have talked to a single tourist to say, well, what would you like to see in a site like this? This is the kind of product that a bunch of talking heads come up with and sums up a lot of what we're seeing coming out of that country. Is it's stuff that's put together, concepts that are put together by people who do not seem to have a very nuanced view of what the existing or pre-COVID tourism scene actually was.
Yeah, I think that's a valid point, Stuart. I think, and I've said this a few times, what has really struck me over these past 9 months is that governments understood the top line value of tourism. They understood that it was an ATM, it was a cash machine that was bringing in revenues to different parts of their economies. But they didn't understand the complexities of the actual tourism sector. And that's become so apparent.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and they just talk about it in dollar terms. You know, this whole conflating quality tourism and high spend tourism like they're the same thing. But they're not. Absolutely, they're not. I mean, hard lessons for everybody to learn, that's for sure. And I mean, the travel industry is being absolutely devastated by this. And I mean, it shows you just how big the shadow of this industry is. That it's not just your front desk staff, but it's the drivers and the room service people and the gardeners and all the families that effectively have relied on these properties. And that's all gone bye-bye. And the governments, I'm not specifically talking about Thailand here, but they need to do a better job of helping these people out.
Definitely, I agree with that. So overall, I mean, how badly do you think independent budget travel and backpacking are going to be hit by the pandemic? I mean, do you see them even recovering?
Well, there was a story this morning where the Thai travel, sorry that I keep going to Thailand, but I've just been so obsessed with that insane hotel story that I was just reading mostly about that this morning. But the Thai Travel Association have come out and said that they want Thailand to remove the 14-day quarantine if the guest is coming from a low-risk country. Maybe you could argue that's possible. But then they went on to say, and we'll require that these people have to book all their travel through a travel agent. Right. So this is like rent seeking. And I mean, backpackers don't need to use travel agents. If they come up with something like that and you've got to go there, but you've got to book tours to everything, like, I don't want to do that. And I don't think many other independent travelers would want to. But the far bigger problem is that in the countries that are traditionally large sources for budget travel, so that's like Australia, New Zealand, Germany, France, Canada, their economies are in a bad way. Unemployment is going through the roof. How many people are actually going to have the money to be able to say, okay, I'm going to take a 6-month holiday to Southeast Asia? I think it's going to be a long time.
I guess the two overlays to that, Stuart, as well, the fact we really at the moment have no idea what's going to happen with long-haul air travel. We don't know how the airlines are going to be able to manage that or even cope with that. Yeah. And the other one, I guess the other important one, is the collapse of STA travel.
Yeah. Well, that's only one of many travel agents that have gone to the wall. But, yeah, it's a huge problem. I mean, I've been saying 18 months to 2 years. I mean, it could well be longer. I mean, particularly with the situation in the Philippines and Indonesia, as long as it remains out of control in those two countries, that's really going to hobble the whole region's recovery. Because, I mean, they're not going to be able, like Malaysia, Singapore, Thailand, if common sense prevails, will not reopen to those two countries. So that's a challenge.
Yeah. So we've got time for a couple more questions, Stuart. I want to ask a couple about yourself because you're an inveterate traveler. Travel is part of your life. It's part of your business. Mm-hmm. How would you feel about getting on a plane right now? Would you feel comfortable traveling domestically or internationally?
No. No way. I mean, with these school holidays that just started, we had considered going to the Gili Islands or to Lombok. But for either of those, I need to get on mass transit. I can either fly or take a ferry. And there's just no way I would do that at the moment. It's, I mean, I know like some of the coverage is saying air travel is safer and that kind of thing, but I'm just not willing to take the risk, particularly with my kids, for a short beach break. You know, I mean, if I had to fly, if you know, for some business reason or whatever, it was unavoidable, then yeah, I mean, I would do it. I wouldn't be very happy about it, but for pure leisure, no way.
Yeah, I think a lot of people feel like, I haven't even been on a domestic travel trip yet. You know, I'm in Malaysia and it's pretty safe here, and I still haven't taken that flight yet. So I'm with you on that one.
I think the fear is going to be regardless of if the fear is warranted, it's going to be a really big challenge for destinations. Because once the destination has lost people's trust, where people don't feel that the government is being transparent about what is going on or what the situation is, then trust is something that is very difficult to earn back. Mm. And it's like, well, I'm just not going to, I don't believe these numbers. So if you're lying about your numbers, what else are you lying about? It'll take a long time, I think, to get over some of the problems that are coming out of this.
Yeah, I think you both make interesting points there. I mean, Stuart, where you are, the situation is quite different. It is in Malaysia. Our borders are still closed. We can travel domestically, but the numbers are much, much lower.
Yeah.
And people are traveling. I mean, I've been on a couple of flights. People are traveling. They're very nervous. They're a little bit reticent, but they are getting on planes. But I do wonder that if they are able to travel internationally again, whether they will actually have a different fear factor than traveling domestically, because we live in a sealed bubble at the moment. You know, borders are closed. The cases are only really a few returnees and a few domestic transmissions. But once you can actually go to countries, you know, it opens up that risk factor so much more.
Well, yeah. I mean, and it's also you're on your flying metal tube for 6 or 10 or 12 hours instead of an hour and a half. You're having to clear customs and immigration. I mean, all these other areas where, despite the best efforts for separation, you're still crammed in with a lot of other people. And the fear is, you know, the fear factor is it only takes one. You know, there was a really good story in The Atlantic the other day that was talking about how the virus spreads. It was fascinating, but it was also terrifying. And I think that fear factor is not insurmountable. Governments will need to be very proactive in addressing it and making sure that people feel like they're going to be safe, that they're not going to die because they decide to go to Thailand for a beach holiday.
So we've got 1 minute. I'm going to ask you both the same question. I'm going to sit on the fence. I'm going to ask you both to answer this. Hannah, you first. Is the only hope for travel now a vaccine?
It's looking that way, isn't it? I hate to say it. I wasn't in that camp, but I think it's looking that way.
Stuart?
I don't know. Like with the vaccine, so at the moment there was a WHO story the other day that was saying there's 169 different vaccine candidates at the moment, of which 26 are in the stage of like human trials. So it's not just going to be a case of one vaccine. It's like, which vaccine? Have you got like the Indonesian vaccine or the Australian vaccine or the whatever, the Russian vaccine or the Mexican one or whatever? And the thing is that if everyone just wore a mask, that would probably be arguable. Like if a vaccine is, say, 80% effective, well, then a mask is up there as well. And we don't need to wait for everybody to wear masks now. Like we can all do that today. I mean, I'm not an epidemiologist, you know, like I don't know much about vaccines. I know a lot more than I wish I did. But I don't think it's something you want to rush. And if a vaccine is rushed out and it turns out to not be effective or to maim or kill people or that they have problems with their children or whatever, then that's going to make it even more difficult when a decent vaccine comes out to get widespread adoption. The thing is, for a vaccine to work, there needs to be widespread adoption. We can have widespread adoption with masks today. And I think that's where, you know, start there.
Strong message. Right, and Gary's sitting on the fence. So
come on, Gary, what do you reckon?
Okay, I'm going to sit even further on the fence and say that I think you're both right, because I do think that the way the travel sector is looking at things, it can't manage this now. Governments themselves have basically given up. We were looking at those lost few months at the beginning of the crisis. I mean, it's so easy with hindsight to say, but if every country around the world had locked down in sync with China for 2 months at the beginning of that period, and we may not be free of COVID-19, but we certainly would not be in this global mess that we're in right now. It's a global chain of infection. We can't actually solve COVID-19 individually in countries. We're seeing that in Malaysia. Now, we have this lockdown. We have the we have the borders closed, but all we're doing is pressing pause, because as soon as the borders open again, you're going to have the virus come back. Exactly. So lockdowns don't work. Masks do work, but so many countries are still struggling with the liberalized impact of what wearing a mask actually means. And, you know, I agree with you about the vaccines in terms of who's producing them, where they're coming from. I mean, you look at our region and you're looking at the way governments are starting to respond, and it looks like China will be very much the dominant actor in this region. But we don't know how many doses you'll need. I mean, like you said, we don't know the epidemiology of all this at the moment. Speaking to a number of travel sector people this week, they're kind of resigned that the vaccine is going to be the only thing that's going to bring back any confidence, but they're not confident that that's going to happen anytime soon. The economic impacts are just getting worse and worse. We're going to turn into 2021 probably in no clearer position of where we're going than we are right now.
Right. I mean, who would have said in March this year that we'd be having this conversation now in October? You know, I remember reading Talking Heads back in March and April saying, this is going to be 3 months and then we're done. Now people are saying, it's going to be 3 years, maybe. You know, in a call I was on the other day, I said, maybe it's going to be 10 years. And people laughed at me. I mean, obviously, I hope it's not going to be 10 years. I mean, the thing is, people don't know. Like I was saying earlier, there are so many moving parts. Countries are not working together. They're each taking their own different approach. And as you said, in the case of Malaysia, as soon as you reopen the doors, what happens? How do you deal with it when it comes back in again? This is where ASEAN should have stepped in months ago and said, right, we're a regional body. We're going to have a regional approach to this. And let's see how we go. But they didn't.
And they're not even meeting again until November. So that's kicking the can, a month and a half down the road.
Well, that brings us to the end of our interview. So thank you very much, Stuart. It's been a pleasure having you on with us again.
My pleasure. Good to talk to you about.
We hope you enjoyed the show. And as always, you know, we would love to hear your feedback on what we or Stuart said or missed out. So email us at hello@seasiatravelshow.com or contact us on Facebook at SEA Travel Show, or catch us on LinkedIn at the Southeast Asia Travel Show and Twitter at SEA Travel Show. And that's a wrap for this week. We'll be back next week with our usual midweek edition and the Friday Rewind show as well. And we look forward to talking Southeast Asian travel and tourism again with you very soon.
Yeah, thanks very much, Stuart.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.